Chapter 15. She thought all letters deserved the courtesy of an answer. Her mother brought her up in that kindly air. She could write a good letter, and was swift with her pen. S.E. had but an indifferent ear music, but her tongue took to languages with an easy facility. She never allowed her Italian, French, and German to get rusty through neglect. The telegrams of sympathy are flowing in, from far and wide, now, just as they did in Italy 5 years and a half ago, when this child's mother laid down her blameless life. They cannot heal the hurt, but they take away some of the pain. When John and I kissed hands, and parted at my door last, how little did we imagine that in 22 hours the telegraph would be bringing words like these. From the bottom of our hearts we send out sympathy, dearest of friends. For many and many a day to come, wherever I go in this house, remembrancers of John will mutely speak to me of her. Who can count the number of them? She was in exile 2 years with the hope of healing her malady epilepsy. There are no words to express how grateful I am that she did not meet her fate in the hands of strangers, but in the loving shelter of her own home. Miss Jean is dead. It is true. John is dead. A month ago I was writing bubbling and hilarious articles for magazines yet to appear, and now I am writing this. Christmas Day. Noon. Last night I went to John's room at intervals, and turned back the sheet and looked at the peaceful face, and kissed the cold brow, and remembered that heartbreaking night in Florence so long ago, in that cavernous and silent vast villa, when I crept downstairs so many times, and turned back a sheet and looked at a face just like this one, John's mother's face, and kissed a brow that was just like this one. And last night I saw again, what I had seen then, that strange and lovely miracle, the sweet, soft contours of early maidenhood restored by the gracious hand of death. When John's mother lay dead, all trace of care, and trouble, and suffering, and the corroding years had vanished out of the face, and I was looking again upon it as I had known, and worshipped it in its young bloom and beauty a whole generation before. About 3 in the morning, while wandering about the house in the deep silences, as one does in times like these, when there is a dumb sense that something has been lost, that will never be found again, yet must be sought, if only for the employment the useless seeking gives, I came upon John's dog in the hall downstairs, and noted that he did not spring to greet me, according to his hospitable habit, but came slow and sorrowfully. Also I remembered that he had not visited John's apartment since the tragedy. Poor fellow, did he know? I think so. Always when John was abroad in the open he was with her. Always when she was in the house he was with her, in the night as well as in the day. Her parlor was his bedroom. Whenever I happened upon him on the ground floor he always followed me about, and when I went upstairs he went too in a tumultuous gallop. But now it was different. After patting him a little I went to the library he remained behind. When I went upstairs he did not follow me, save with his wistful eyes. He has wonderful eyes, big, and kind, and eloquent. He can talk with them. He is a beautiful creature, and is of the breed of the New York police dogs. I do not like dogs, because they bark when there is no occasion for it. But I have liked this one from the beginning, because he belonged to John, and because he never barks except when there is occasion, which is not oftener than twice a week. In my wanderings I visited John's parlor. On a shelf I found a pile of my books, and I knew what it meant. She was waiting for me to come home from Bermuda and autograph them, then she would send them away. If I only knew whom she intended them for. But I shall never know. I will keep them. Her hand has touched them, it is an accolade, they are noble now. And in a closet as he had hidden a surprise for me, a thing I have often wished I owned. A noble big globe. I couldn't see it for the tears. She will never know the pride I take in it, and the pleasure. Today the mails are full of loving remembrances for her. Full of those old, old kind words she loved so well, Merry Christmas to John. If she could only have lived one day longer. At last she ran out of money, and would not use mine. So she sent to one of those New York homes for poor girls all the clothes she could spare and more, most likely. Christmas night. This afternoon they took her away from her room. As soon as I might, I went down to the library, and there she lay, in her coffin, dressed in exactly the same clothes she wore when she stood at the other end of the same room on the 6th of October last, as Clara's chief bridesmaid. Her face was radiant with happy excitement then. It was the same face now, with the dignity of death and the peace of God upon it. They told me the first mourner to come was the dog. He came uninvited, and stood upon his hind legs, and rested his forepaws upon the trestle, and took a last long look at the face that was so dear to him, then went his way as silently as he had come. He knows. At mid-afternoon it began to snow. The pity of it that John could not see it. She so loved the snow. The snow continued to fall. At 6 o'clock the hearse drew up to the door, to bear away its pathetic burden. As they lifted the casket, Payne began playing on the orchestrelle Schubert's impromptu, which was John's favorite. Then he played the intermezzo, that was for Susie. Then he played the largo, that was for their mother. He did this at my request. Elsewhere in my autobiography I have told how the intermezzo and the largo came to be associated in my heart with Susie and Livy in their last hours in this life. From my windows I saw the hearse and the carriages wind along the road and gradually grow vague and spectral in the falling snow and presently disappear. John was gone out of my life and would not come back anymore. Jervis, the cousin she had played with when they were babies together, he and her beloved old Katie were conducting her to her distant childhood home, where she will lie by her mother's side once more, in the company of Susie and Langdon. December 26th. The dog came to see me at 8 o'clock this morning. He was very affectionate. Poor orphan. My room will be his quarters hereafter. The storm raged all night. It has raged all the morning. The snow drives across the landscape in vast clouds, superb, sublime, and John not here to see. 2:30 p.m. It is the time appointed. The funeral has begun. 400 miles away, but I can see it all, just as if I were there. The scene is the library in the Langdon homestead. John's coffin stands where her mother and I stood, 40 years ago, and were married, and where Susie's coffin stood 13 years ago, where her mother stood 5 years and a half ago, and where mine will stand after a little time. 5 o'clock. It is all over. When Clara went away 2 weeks ago to live in Europe, it was hard, but I could bear it, for I had John left. I said we would be a family. We said we would be close comrades and happy just we two. That fair dream was in my mind, when John met me at the steamer last Monday. It was in my mind, when she received me at the door last Tuesday evening. We were together. We were a family. The dream had come true, oh, precisely true, contentedly true, satisfyingly true. And remained true 2 whole days. And now? Now John is in her grave. In the grave, if I can believe it. God rest her sweet spirit. 1. Katie Leary, who had been in the service of the Clemens family for 29 years. 2. Mr. Gabrilowitsch had been operated on for appendicitis. The turning point of my life? If I understand the idea, the Baser invites several of us to write upon the above text. It means the change in my life's course which introduced what must be regarded by me as the most important condition of my career. But it also implies, without intention, perhaps that turning point itself was the creator of the new condition. This gives it too much distinction, too much prominence, too much credit. It is only the last link in a very long chain of turning points commissioned to produce the cardinal result. It is not any more important than the humblest of its 10,000 predecessors. Each of the 10,000 did its appointed share, on its appointed date, in forwarding the scheme, and they were all necessary, who have left out any one of them would have defeated the scheme and brought about some other result. But though we have a fashion of saying such and such an event was the turning point in my life, but we shouldn't say it. We should merely grant that its place as last link in the chain makes it the most conspicuous link. In real importance, it has no advantage over any one of its predecessors. Perhaps the most celebrated turning point recorded in history was the crossing of the Rubicon. Suetonius says, coming up with his troops on the banks of the Rubicon, he halted for a while, and, revolving in his mind the importance of the step he was on the point of taking, he turned to those about him and said, "We may still retreat, but if we pass this little bridge, nothing is left for us but to fight it out in arms." This was a stupendously important moment, and all the incidents, big and little, of Caesar's previous life had been leading up to it, stage by stage, link by link. This was the last link, merely the last one, and no bigger than the others. But as we gaze back at it through the inflating mists of our imagination, it looks as big as the orbit of Neptune. You, the reader, have a personal interest in that link, and so have I, so has the rest of the human race. It was one of the links in your life chain, and it was one of the links in mine. We may wait now, with bated breath, while Caesar reflects. Your fate and mine are involved in his decision. While he was thus hesitating, the following incident occurred. A person remarked for his noble mien and graceful aspect appeared close at hand, sitting and playing upon a pipe, when not only the shepherds, but a number of soldiers also, flocked to listen to him, and some trumpeters among them. He snatched a trumpet from one of them, ran to the river with it, and, sounding the advance with a piercing blast, crossed to the other side. Upon this, Caesar exclaimed, "Let us go whither the omens of the gods, and the iniquity of our enemies call up. The die is cast." So he crossed and changed the future of the whole human race, for all time. But that stranger was a link in Caesar's life chain too, and a necessary one. We don't know his name, we never hear of him again. He was very casual, he acts like an accident, but he was no accident. He was there by compulsion of his life chain, to blow the electrifying blast that was to make up Caesar's mind for him, and thence go piping down the aisles of history forever. If the stranger hadn't been there, but he was, and Caesar crossed, with such results, such vast events, each a link in the human race's life chain, each event producing the next one, and that one the next one, and so on. The destruction of the Republic, the founding of the Empire, the breaking up of the Empire, the rise of Christianity upon its ruins, the spread of the religion to other lands, and so on. Link by link, took its appointed place at its appointed time, the discovery of America being one of them, our revolution another, the inflow of English and other immigrants another, their drift westward, my ancestors among them, another, the settlement of certain of them in Missouri, which resulted in me, for I was one of the unavoidable results of the crossing of the Rubicon. If the stranger, with his trumpet blast, had stayed away, which he couldn't, for he was the appointed link, Caesar would not have crossed. What would have happened, in that case, we can never guess. We only know that the things that did happen would not have happened. They might have been replaced by equally prodigious things, of course, but their nature and results are beyond our guessing. But the matter that interests me personally is that I would not be here now, but somewhere else, and probably black there is no telling. Very well, I am glad he crossed. And very really and thankfully glad too, though I never cared anything about it before. 2. To me, the most important feature of my life is its literary feature. I have been professionally literary something more than 40 years. There have been many turning points in my life, but the one that was the link in the chain appointed to conduct me to the Literary Guild is the most conspicuous link in that chain, because it was the last one. It was not any more important than its predecessors. All the other links have an inconspicuous look, except the crossing of the Rubicon. But as factors in making me literary, they are all of the one size, the crossing of the Rubicon included. I know how I came to be literary, and I will tell the steps that lead up to it, and brought it about. The crossing of the Rubicon was not the first one, it was hardly even a recent one. I should have to go back ages before Caesar's day to find the first one. To save space, I will go back only a couple of generations and start with an incident of my boyhood. When I was 12 and a half years old, my father died. It was in the spring. The summer came, and brought with it an epidemic of measles. For a time, a child died almost every day. The village was paralyzed with fright, distress, despair. Children that were not smitten with the disease were imprisoned in their homes to save them from the infection. In the homes? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.